Welcome to the latest episode of The Grower and The Economist. I'm Michelle Klieger, The Economist.
And I'm Peter Kanjoyan, The Grower.
Each week, we team up to tackle the biggest challenges facing small and medium-sized growers. We're one part grower and one part economist, just like your business.
John, we'll ask you for a little background as introduction, your career path and how you got where you are. And Michelle will kind of lead the way, and I'll jump in with questions and comments as we go.
Sure. Well, my name's John Bennett. I've been in advertising and marketing my whole professional career. I started in the business, 30 years ago or so as a cinematographer doing commercials and music videos and stuff like that. First big break was with the National Basketball Association in New York. I helped create a show for NBC called Inside Stuff and did a lot of really great things in New York. And then I decided to get married and have kids and didn't really want to raise my kids in New York. So I moved to Massachusetts and started raising kids and still doing creative director work in the advertising and marketing space, and worked for a local CBS affiliate, started and grew an advertising agency to about 60 people, sold out of that, and continued to do advertising until not that long ago. Goats came into the equation one Sunday afternoon. I was watching the football game. My lovely partner came home and said, "Come outside, I have something to show you." And there are three baby goats in the back of the station wagon. And we had talked about it once, and she was going to, with a friend, buy some goats that day and just couldn't not buy goats. And so came home with three goats, and her friend had a place that they could stay until I put up a fence and started building barns and stuff like that. And so that's how it got started. So we had three or four goats at the time and kind of kept adding goats, and my partner would come home with goats again here and then, and it's started to grow, and then they have babies and war came. And then I was working for a tech company, and the pandemic hit and they laid off 70% of the workforce on a Friday afternoon via email. And I said, wow, I think that might be my last corporate gig. And decided to go into goatscaping and put up a website, and a week later had more work than we could keep up with, and we've been kind of growing it slowly and steadily since then.
And when the goats first arrived, what age were your children? How many children?
They were grown already. My kids are, middle, 29, 25, 24 at this point. So they weren't around, but the grandkids were, and they love the goats. So. But it started as basically a little backyard hobby, and now it's getting bigger than that.
And John, in your earlier life in marketing and advertising, where did you grow up? Where did you go to school? Did you have any formal training in it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I grew up in Millis, Massachusetts, and then I went to college in Valdosta, Georgia. My father's whole family is from the Deep South, and I kind of spent a lot of my summers down there and really loved the South, and went to Valdosta State University and studied film and communication there. And that's where my kind of formal training came. It was a very hands-on program. So when I got out, I knew how to shoot and edit pretty well. And that's what gave me a foot into the marketplace, and grew it from there basically.
Well, you're a testament to, you're never too old to get involved in agriculture. So welcome to the podcast.
Well, I just have to be honest. I've always had an affinity towards goats. As an animal science major, I called my dad who sold meat, and I was like, we should have more goats. So we should have many goats, because goat meat market with different populations from the Caribbean and from the Middle East are really interested in goat meat. And and every time I'd see an article, I'd send it to them. I went to school in Maryland near DC, and so they use goats to mow the congressional cemetery because it's on a slope, and then you see them in the medians. And so like every time these things come up, I'm like, see, goats are the answers. But I have never showed up at home with three goats. So
they're big in California. They're clearing a lot of land in California with goats, specifically to help keep the wildfire situation down. And they've been very successful out there. They usually go with the bigger breeds of goats, like Swiss dairy goats and stuff like that. We primarily, almost exclusively, run with miniature Nigerian goats, which are a small breed, easy to move, about 25 to 28 inches at the shoulder when they're full grown, and weigh maybe 40 to 60 pounds, depending on the goat. And like I said, one of the big reasons is they're easy to move because they're not so big. The bigger goats, we have some bigger goats and we have access to bigger goats, and they can be more of a challenge. In fact, we've had to learn how to lasso because if a goat doesn't want to come, it's really hard to catch a goat that doesn't want to come. So now every once in a while, we'll go on a goat roundup, and which is more fun to watch than to participate in, I can tell you that. But yeah, actually my buddy in Rhode Island who helped me get started too, because he's been farming and doing agriculture for a long time. He has bigger goats and does do some meat goat work as well with those populations you mentioned. And he's done well with that. But we've tried to figure out other ways beyond meat, because miniature Nigerians are not very big. You wouldn't get a lot of meat off them, but other ways to monetize them. So we do our primary business from kind of Memorial Day through middle of November is goatscaping, where we clear land. We do a lot of goat visits, which we call goatograms, which is like an hour visit. We bring two baby goats to your house and hang out for an hour. We do birthday parties. We do goat yoga. We do goat Zoom calls. And we even have a friend who's a grief counselor who uses the goats and grief therapy work. So any non-harmful way to monetize a goat, we're always into talking about.
Well, I can't wait to call and schedule perhaps a meeting out at my place to have my granddaughters and grandchildren around. That would be wonderful coming up in the spring or summer. Now, of the three of us guys, I'm the one here with no animal experience. So before we get into the actual goatscaping, John, help me understand, do both sexes of goats have horns?
Yes, they can. Both can, and they can both have beards as well.
Okay, the only goat that I'm familiar with is when I'm in the Rockies in Colorado climbing. Every now and then there'll be mountain goats,
yeah,
white, long-haired.
Yeah.
And I've learned that when they're on the trail before I am, they take the right of way. So it's up to their way. They won't move. So
no, that's a bigger goat and they're going to do what they want to do. And I don't know that much about that breed, but they're hardy for sure.
Okay. Well, thank you. So now let's get into the topic at hand, goatscaping. Tell us what it is, how you learned about it, and what's going on.
Well, how I learned about it was really just reading and watching a million videos and learning as much as I possibly could off the internet, basically. But goatscaping is essentially we bring goats to areas and we set up a portable electric fence, which looks like a big fishing net. And we put the goats out and they eat a lot of stuff. Invasive plants, they love dense woody material. Fortunately, that's stuff like poison ivy and bittersweet and buckthorn and the things that people don't want around. They don't like grass so much. They'll eat it, but if we're doing jobs where there's a lot of longer grasses, we'll integrate goats and sheep together because the sheep will focus on the grass and the goats will eat the dense woody material. So essentially what happens is we go into areas a lot of times that you can't even walk through. It's so dense and overgrown. I mean, bittersweet that's 25 feet high and 10 foot thick, you know, and we'll cut a path through using a pair of loppers to cut the tall stuff down. And then we'll walk through that same path again with a weed whacker with a metal blade on the bottom. We'll cut everything right down to the soil as much as we can because you want a nice clean contact with the fence and the ground. And then we'll unravel this fence, which comes in rolls. Like I said, it's like a big fishing net. It goes in the ground on stakes. We'll stake that all out. We add the fence energizer box, which sends the electricity to the fence, which we try to run on solar whenever we can. To keep things as green as we possibly can. Goats have very thick fur, so our fences put out a substantial amount of energy. It's basically about 7 joules of energy, which is kind of where they start the heart paddles if you're having a heart attack. So the fence puts out a really good jolt of electricity. Trust me, I've been hit by it too many times. But you need that to keep the goats in. They will push the boundaries. Goats love to get out of fences. So if the fence is good and hot, they'll stay in. And if they have enough food, they'll stay in. A bored goat is a dangerous goat. So you got to keep them interested, right? Goats are also very ADD. So if we go into an area and we're clearing an acre of land, we wouldn't fence the whole acre to begin with, because they'll eat over here and they'll eat over there, and it's very impossible to kind of monitor the progress. So we'll usually do 100 feet by 100 feet by 50 feet by 50 feet, a big rectangle. We put up a portable structure, a pop-up tent, and they stay overnight. You know, they hate the rain. It's the only thing. So, but in from May through November, it's not that cold, so they're fine with the temperature. You just want to keep them dry. So they'll stay, and we'll check on them once a day. And usually the homeowner wants to get involved, so we'll let the homeowner give them water and do stuff like that. And we'll monitor their progress, and we'll add more fencing as we go. And we basically just keep moving these boxes of fences around the property until the goats are done. This number holds up really well. A herd of 10 goats will clear a quarter of an acre in approximately 7 days. That's they eat about a third of their body weight a day. And because of their complex digestive system, when they process the food, their poop has no viable seed material left. So they
That was my question, was are you just reseeding with the invasive plant?
No, you're not, which is amazing. And their digestive systems are really, they break everything down, so there's no material left. In fact, they get most of their nutrients during the digestive process, releases enzymes in their gut, and that's really their fuels. That's why they eat so much. There's a lot of plants goats can't eat. That was my learning curve at the beginning with me. Everybody thinks goats can eat tin cans and all this other stuff, but there's actually a substantial list of plants they can't eat, or they get really sick and even die. Cornell Vet School puts out a very good list that we keep on our phones, and we also have a couple apps that identify plants. So the first step on any site visit we do and before any goats get in is we walk every square foot of where they're going to be, and we look for anything to them. We either pull that by hand or we fence it off so they can't get at it. They have a good intuitive sense of what not to eat, just because that's thousands of years of evolution have taught them that. But goats will get into stuff, and you have to make sure that they're in a safe place before we put anything in. Obviously, that's one of our main concerns. There's a lot of weird interactive things in nature too. There's a thing called deer worm, which is a parasite that deer pick up. And if we're working near wetlands, we're very concerned about that, because when the deer poop, if there are slugs in the area and the slugs move through the poop, the slug trail that the slug leaves behind gets on the leaves. And if the goats eat the leaves with the slug trail, they can get this parasite and get very, very sick, a neurological disease that goes right to their spinal column and can paralyze them. So there's a lot of circle of life stuff that we have to know. It's not just throw up a fence and put some goats in there. You really have to know what you're doing.
Well, you know, the deer, Michelle and I talk about that often, John, and in my wooded area up here in Andover, the deer are now, they're like rodents, you know, they're everywhere. And I've been treated for Lyme disease 3 times in the last half dozen years. So it sounds like this is something similar that the goats you have to worry about.
Yeah, I mean, it's mostly the deer. It's mostly the parasite I mentioned, but obviously deer and carrying a ton of ticks right now, and it's very prevalent in Dover as well. I've had Lyme disease twice and been treated for it twice as well. So we're always on the lookout for how to stay safe with that. There's been some research as well that says that the mice population is carrying a lot of those ticks too, and actually deer and mice together are really a big part of the problem. I mean, the problem is there's no natural predators except coyotes right now, and coyotes can only take down so many deer. I mean, there's just the deer population is just out of control, as is the turkey population. Massachusetts started restocking turkeys in the mid-90s, I think it was, and it just exploded. I mean, they're everywhere. Not good for the biosystem, because there's just too many of one thing, you know.
Well, you've obviously, your finger is right on the pulse of it, because just about everything you're mentioning, John, is something that I'm experiencing here on my property as a pest. So the bittersweet and the poison ivy, I mean, I put them in that order. Bittersweet is just taking over. Yeah. And then the rodents and the deer, I mean, the mice and the deer are a constant concern for me. And my physician and I last year about this time, I think I encountered a mouse transmitted issue that resulted in some joint pain that eventually, you know, we treated it. But so let me ask a question halfway into this conversation. I have a bed of Pachysandra and poison ivy growing in it. Are our friends selective? Would they eat the poison ivy and not the Pachysandra?
Yeah, they tend to be very selective and they don't like Pachysandra, so they won't eat that. If they are in that area and they can get to the poison ivy through the Pachysandra, they will selectively eat the poison ivy, which is pretty cool. You know, just a side note on that, how it's all connected issue. There's some research that came out about 2 years ago, specifically about poison ivy and how the hypothesis is that the increase in CO2 in the atmosphere is fueling poison ivy specifically. It's more virulent than it's ever been, and the active ingredient that causes the rash is more distilled than it's ever been. I can tell you firsthand, just being out in the woods a lot, that you know I'm seeing it earlier and earlier every year, and I'm seeing it bigger and bigger every year. And we're in it, you know, up to our waist, you know, almost all the time in the spring and summer. Take a lot of precautions not to get it, but it's a dangerous plant now because it's growing so fast and so potent. So it's there's a lot of bad stuff happening in the because we're not taking care of the planet.
Okay, another question then for if you're going to a private residence homeowner like myself and. And given the conversation with the ticks and the deer and the mice, for the last 5 years, I've had a spray service, a tick mosquito treating service. I only ask for tick treatment. That's something that you need to research. Does that impact whether you do or do not go in onto a property if it's under that type of treatment?
Yeah, it's certainly one of the questions that we always ask up front is, are you using any pesticides? What are they? We look up the ingredients, and a lot of it is how long after a spray would you put them in? And depending on what the ingredients in the pesticide are or the herbicide, it can be safe to put goats in if there's enough time that's passed. I don't like doing it, and if there's something there that's even questionable, we won't do it. But there are, I mean, obviously there are less toxic pesticides and herbicides available now too that use some of the more naturopathic things that have been known for a long time to help with pests that and insects that I would always prefer people use an approach like that rather than a heavy chemical bomb, you know. But the thing is, if we know for sure that the area has been, you know, sprayed, we'll first of all look up the components of what it's been sprayed with, check and see what the half-life is, if you will, of that stuff, and make a decision based on that.
Cool. That, having grown up on a farm and you and I are of a similar generation, the chemicals that we used to use on the farm, Michelle's heard me say this over and over, were just so potent back in the 70s and 80s. It was just our ignorance. You know, we didn't do it on purpose. We didn't know any better. But I'm assuming now that any of these public services, these tick mosquito treatments, they're all using greener, softer chemistries on residential properties. Do you find that to be true?
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely not an expert with that, but you know, there's definitely I anecdotally have seen plenty of, you know, tick companies advertising that they use a different approach, and it's, you know, stuff that's been in nature before. You know, can't think of one of the actual things that they use, but there seems to be a movement to try to do it less with less toxicity than there used to be, like you said, in the 70s when it was just bomb it so that we can improve yield as much as possible. Cause you know, I was in agriculture in the South too, with, you know, soybeans and tobacco and a bunch of other stuff. And, you know, they would lay down a pretty heavy chemical bomb to get maximum yield. You know, how that impacts the land over time is obviously not good, and water and everything else. I mean, I get very concerned about streams. I do a lot of fly fishing, and I like to keep streams as clean as we can keep them. So,
yeah.
Well, and I assume part of this is the appeal people have of coming to your business is that you're getting rid of a lot of these plants without having to apply the herbicides to them.
Yeah. And there's no, you know, there's no noise and there's no smell. I mean, go, you know, we should talk about poop, right? Goat poop is like little raisins, and it's super low in nitrogen. And the lower in nitrogen the poop is, the less smell it has. So goat poop has really next to no odor unless it builds up in an area and starts to decompose. On its own, over the course of a week or two of a goatscaping gig, you're not going to smell the goats. I mean, you will, you may smell the males if they're emitting some of the hormones that they emit when they're getting frisky. It starts to smell a little bit like a junior high boys locker room, you know. But other than that, you really won't smell goat poop. And it's a great fertilizer. It's a cold fertilizer. You can put it in the garden without any kind of composting. That's our next line of business, is selling goat poop.
Well, sure. It's very popular right now. The U.S. government put a lot of money towards finding more sources of fertilizer last year. So,
well, low in nitrogen is a good thing for the smell, and it's also just, it's a high quality fertilizer. It's very green.
It sounds like you started with the goat scaping. So did people come to you with the parties and the grams and the yoga, or did you?
No, it's probably a little bit more the other way around. We had fewer goats, started advertising to do goat visits and goat parties and stuff like that. And once we had the herd built up a pretty good bit, then really started to focus on goat scaping from, you know, May through November every year, and having enough animals to be able to do that at scale. Right now we have approximately 40 goats. We usually put them out.
18 on your website, which they're very cute.
Yeah, the website needs to get updated. And when I decided to do a gallery, I didn't really look long term and realize how much I would have to keep the photos up to date. But yeah, that's funny. We'll go on a goat visit and somebody say, "Oh, can you bring Daisy?" And I'll say, "Well, she's a lot bigger than she used to be on the site." So we usually try to bring the littlest goats that we have at the time to visits, because people love the baby goats. And, you know, every spring we have more baby goats. I think we had 14 last year and 13 the year before. So the herd can grow very quickly. We're this coming spring is the first time we actually be started selling some goats as well.
You may have covered this, but how many makes up a team or a job?
We generally will put them out in herds of 10. Last year, given the price of gas when it really skyrocketed, I made a decision to not take any work that was smaller than a quarter of an acre. Before that, we had been doing even smaller jobs than that, like 3-day jobs, 2-day jobs like that. Depending on the size of the area, we would put smaller herds out, you know, no less than 4. But moving to a quarter of an acre or more has been very good for the gas part of the equation, because the smaller jobs, obviously, we got to move them more. And the more we move them, that's more transportation and more gas and all that. It's also more manual labor, because we got to go set up more and more fence lines, and it is what it is. So this coming season, I hope to keep it at a quarter of an acre, because a quarter of an acre is basically a week-long job, which is a pretty good way to manage it. And like I said, a herd of 10, I would say 85% of the time, they'll stay on that schedule where they'll eat a quarter of an acre in about 7 days. I mean, some of it's depending on density. Yeah. It's a super dense area, it could take a little longer. If it's not so dense, it could be a little shorter. But that estimate holds up pretty good.
And you brought up coyote as a natural predator.
Mm-hmm.
And once a month or so during the night, I'll hear them howling. Sometimes pretty close to my property, which abuts with some conservation land along the Merrimack mm-hmm. River.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you manage that if the goats are on location for a week?
Yeah, it's a good question. Well, there's certainly been situations where I know we've been putting goats in areas where there's heavy coyote population. So it's a big concern of ours all the time. The defense starts with the fence. The fence, like I said, puts out a substantial amount of energy. If a dog hits that fence, the dog will not come back to that area, sometimes for days. So my assumption, not that I've seen coyotes hit the fence, is that a coyote would act similarly, because they're going to get a hell of a shock. The second thing that we'll do, if I know that we're in an area with dense population of coyotes, is we'll put some motion sensors out along the perimeter of the fence that have light and sound that'll go off. So if that gets tripped, it makes a loud noise and the light comes on, which is another deterrent to the coyotes. I have been in situations before where I know for sure that there's an active pack in the area, and I've actually done a fence within a fence. So I'll put a separate fence up around the enclosure, around the pop-up structure for the goats. So there's a fence around the perimeter, and at night they're in yet another fence, both of which are electrified. So the theory is, if a coyote made it over the first fence, he's probably not going to make it over the second fence. And the goats themselves they'll protect themselves. They'll pot up kind of like a herd of buffalo, with the big ones in the front and the little ones in the back. And a goat that doesn't want to be messed with is going to fight back. I mean, they'll use their horns and they'll ram, and you know, they'll stand up for themselves. Thankfully, we have yet to have any interactions with coyotes that I know of. We'll put a field cam up every once in a while too, just to monitor what happens at night. And I haven't even seen coyotes on camera. So are they aware of the fence? Are they being deterred by that? I'm not really sure, because can't really get inside their mind, but I do like putting up the field cam and see what happens. We get a lot of deer coming up to check out the goats, but I haven't seen coyote.
Okay.
I worry more about fisher cats than anything, because they're just really dangerous. They're mean. They're like wolverines. They have no fear, and they will, they've been known to kill deer.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, okay, let's go back to your herd of 40 or so goats that you maintain.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing that your property is pretty well goat-scaped.
Yeah.
So what's their diet? What are you feeding them?
Oh, this time of year, they'll get hay 2 to 3 times a day, and a little bit of grain in the morning just when they come out, and a little bit of grain at night to put them in. But it's hay, and the price of hay has skyrocketed. The price of hay went from about $9.50 a bale to, sometimes $16 a bale for second cut hay, which is what we like, because it's got a lot of selenium. It's what they prefer. They'll eat first cut, but they won't really dig into it. So this time of year, hay two to three times a day is their main source of food. And we don't keep all our goats here. We have another piece of land in Millis, Massachusetts, where we keep all our bucks. We have 11 bucks right now, three of which are viable that we use for breeding. The rest have been neutered when they were young.
Can you tell when spring arrives and they start getting green food? Do you sense them? Do they get excited that the hay is now gone and we're eating good stuff?
Yeah, the moms and babies, and that's in the spring, they're not going to go out because the babies are too small. They'll get stuck in the fences, and that's not good. But any goats that are big enough to go work, we take them out, not even just the first time, but for any time. We'll go out and we'll cut the fence line and put all that up and get ready and bring the trailer in and unload the goats. Boy, they hit the new stuff. It's like bushes are shaking and leaves are flying. I call them four-legged piranha.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember Cool Hand Luke.
Yes.
You remember the scene where it's still shaking it over here, boss, still shaking it over here? It's the same way I'm telling you, the branches and leaves are like shaking and flying, and they're like voraciously. It's crazy. It's like when they first hit a new area, it's they tear into it, boy. They really do.
That sounds cool.
It is.
Okay, as I wind down my questions, John, with your time with us today, have you been in business long enough? What's the life expectancy of one of these animals? Have you ever retired one yet?
No, I haven't been in it that long. The life expectancy for this breed is 12 to 15 years. You know, take care of them, and that's about how long they'll live. So that's a good question, though. I'm not sure if we'll ever have to retire any of them, but I don't look forward to losing any of them to old age, but I guess that's part of the part of the game too.
Okay. Well, Michelle, I will never establish a relationship with a sprayer of mine, but I can understand where someone like John establishes relationships with his herbicide applicators, or however we want to describe them. This is really interesting.
Yeah, it does the job. I mean, and people have been using goats to keep their properties clear since they've been domesticated animals. I mean, goats are one of the first domesticated animals, and they do a great job. They're just really amazing. They're amazing eaters. They love to eat.
You know, so again, Michelle, me, animals, I'm not trained in animals, but I'm closing my eyes, looking out my window, and I'm seeing, okay, I might have a goat here. It's got horns. I might have a deer with antlers. These are two animals that, you know, to the untrained eye, they're similar animals. It's not like a fish compared to a giraffe. And learning today that the goat is so selective in the diet, while the deer has caused me as a horticulturist to stop planting about 50% of the ornamental species that I want to plant in my yard. I find that fascinating that one animal will eat the poison ivy, not the pachycandra, and then the other one will eat any shrub that I plant.
So the deer will eat the pachycandra too?
No, they don't eat either of those, but so that's unrelated a little bit. I mean, the deer, I can't grow peach trees, I can't grow holly. You know, there's a whole list of things that I've learned the hard way not to plant.
Yeah, I mean, the goats are always going to be beyond the perimeter of the backyard too, right? So it's more the, you know, naturally occurring invasives. They're not going to be right up against the house, because we would fence off anything that's, you know, decorative or whatever. But, you know, it's like they can't eat rhododendrons, which are occurring, you know, in the wild around here all the time, right? So we have to fence those off, right? There's a lot of weird stuff that happens out there, like wild cherry, which is everywhere around here in Massachusetts. But they can eat as much of that as they want when it's green. But when the wild cherry dies down for the fall, when the leaves turn brown, a chemical reaction happens in the leaf that generates cyanide. If a goat gets even a couple of leaves of that cherry tree that have turned to cyanide, they'll get sick and die fast. So let's say we're goatscaping a property in the middle of July and there's wild cherry. Like I said, it's everywhere around here. Thunderstorm comes through and knocks some of that stuff down. It's going to turn brown pretty quickly, 2-3 days. So we have to be aware of where that stuff is and go in and take out anything that's fallen down so it doesn't turn to cyanide. So there's a lot of understanding about plants that goes into this, you know. And it's you know, one of the questions people always ask is will goatscaping completely eradicate the invasives that are there? And the answer is we don't know, because we can't look under the ground to see how well established a root system is, right? And I usually use the analogy of a carpet, right? So if the ground has a nice tight carpet of plants you want there, you're going to get a whole lot fewer invasives because they can't get in there. But if there's space, the invasives are going to come in and opportunistically take those spaces over and then push everything else out. So what I tell our clients is have a plan for when the goats leave. When the goats leave, you're never going to have a cleaner palette to work from, right? So what we recommend is let the goats leave, then go in there and dig out anything else that's in there. Pull out, dig out best you can. And then we really want people to replant with native indigenous plants there, grasses, trees, whatever you want, but keep it native. That's what we advise. And understand that that can get expensive for folks. So I say, okay, well, if you can't replant everything, pick your spots where you can plant and then lay down two layers of landscape fabric where you can't and cover that with mulch or wood chips, just to keep the carpet tight, and then gradually push a little bit of the carpet away, replant more, and keep, hopefully over time, reestablish that with all indigenous plants.
you did an excellent job kind of bringing the conversation to a natural closing. And it's so true that in so many facets of agriculture, we've learned that there's no magic bullet. There's right. nothing. So to hear you talk and advise someone to that this is an integrated approach. The goat yep. is one step or one part of the approach. I think that's so important.
Yeah, I mean, there's not a huge body of literature that's built up about goat scaping, although it is growing. And some folks claim that, you know, multiple applications of goats can eradicate certain plants. And that makes perfect sense, right? So it's like, because you're starving the plant of food, right? And, you know, going back, the old wisdom, there's a saying that says, go small or go in the fall when it comes to invasives, right? So go small when the invasives are trying to get established and cut off their food supply. Or go in the fall when they're trying to store their energy for the winter, cut off their food supply, you stand a better chance of eradicating.
Yeah, good. Well, I've thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. Thank you for bringing a different side of agriculture into the conversation.
Sure, we're happy to speak to anybody who has questions. You can check out our website, which is really simple, goatsofdover.com. We like to say, you know, it's G-O-D, Goats of Dover.
Okay.
We like to say if you have weeds, call God. But yeah, we're happy to answer questions. We always start the process with asking some questions, and then if it sounds like it's a good fit, we'll come out and do a free site visit to really take a look at the land and see what's there and go from there.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Grower and The Economist. If you enjoyed the episode, please rate it wherever you listen to podcasts. It helps us get discovered by new listeners. If you have questions, concerns, or would like to suggest a podcast topic, please email me at michelle@stratagerm.com. I love hearing from you. Until next time.